This is September 14th, 2008. We're talking to Ad Absurdum. That's A-D. The first name, second name is A-B, as in Bob. A-B-S-U-R-D-U-M. Ad Absurdum. And he's a diver and scholar of Xenocrine. Let's see what he's come up with from the Slack Gasso Sea.
Oh, far too much. Far too much. Excellent to present in a tidy package, that's for sure. We'll just have to begin a giant ranting tour of it and see how far we can get. these little curlicues and embellishments of the whole thing, they always they pile up and they disappear all the way into the woods. Like, you could follow all sorts of these trails all over the place. Just even getting ready to do this means all sorts of other things happened to me, like today, since the last time I talked to you. So I'll try not to get too distracted by everything.
These would be the curlicues of the Orphic Baroque spirals on my chart.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, and just little jokes.
Yeah.
From the meme or something. Like, I picked up a Globe and Mail book section. There's a book review of the new book by the guy who wrote This Is Your Brain on Music. I put some quotes up from that book on Five Bodied, and I used the phenomenon of the restoration of the missing fundamental, where your brain knows how a tone is structured, and if they synthetically produce a tone that has all the proper overtones but does not have the bass tone, then your brain will fill in the bass tone, and they've proved this with not only just humans but other mammals as well. And so, which is, I commented on that in relation to the ghost of Rye syndrome or something, the missing fundamental.
Good.
This
was today's book review.
A book review of his new book was out today in the Globe and Mail. And apparently this author, Daniel Levitin, he's actually speaking in Toronto 2 days from now. I'm going to go see him. Apparently he's a pretty hardcore neo-Darwinist, and one of the things that he says in this new book that doesn't have to do with music, but the author picked it out as interesting, is sex doesn't intrinsically feel good. Those of our ancestors who enjoyed it are those whose children live to tell about it. And as I'm reacting to that with a bit of a, like, well, that's really something to say. That's a pretty controversial statement.
Yes.
This guy rode by on a bike and seemingly not talking to anyone, he says, "Fuck yeah, fuck yeah."
Well, you say I missed that. He rode on a bike. What did you mean by that?
Oh, just I was outside at the time while I was reading this review earlier today.
Oh, and a guy rode by on a bike and went, "Fuck yeah, fuck yeah."
Right after I'd read, "Sex doesn't intrinsically feel good."
Good one.
Yeah, a little, like, you know, the meme pokes these little jokes.
Hilarious. Excellent.
So, anyway, that's, you know, that's just like, I could get bogged down in little joke stories like that. I'm more interested in some larger, more giant spirals, and I guess probably a good thing to focus on would be Xenocrine's that have involved Alt-Slack.
Yes.
and my interactions with Alt-Slack.
Yes.
Probably the most surprising of which, one of my very first posts on Alt.Slack was in response to something that stunned me. On Leap Day, so I had big Xenocrine this year on Leap Day, as well as 4 years ago on Leap Day, February 29th.
Wow.
Because 4 years ago on Leap Day was the first performance of my band, which is called Slobbering Anus. It's basically all mouth sounds, a beatbox project, but we whereas most people with beatbox are basically trying to sound like a drum machine, like, we make use of the full wetness of the apparatus, so it sounds much more messy that way, hence the name. But anyway, we had our first performance early in the morning on a Sunday, on Leap Day, and then later in that day, I log on to Alt.Slack, and a guy by the name of Dr. Dark, who I think is still on there.
Yes.
He had posted that day a new thread titled Turd Magic.
Wow.
And just a little riff. It was good. Just some little riff about how that's the best type of magic, or that's the genie I should be practicing. He was calling it doo doo voodoo, and he had a good lineup of jokes about it. It was just one long paragraph, but one of the things that he said in there was, I have it written down here. I went to the net today to get that quote. He said, "Substitute drum beats with bum beats."
Wow,
which is precisely what we do.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty incredible. And one of the things he said was, "Can't you hear the spirits of doo doo voodoo calling you?" That's funny. And I responded. I was like, "Oh, dude, that was us. You somehow perceived me doing this." So that was pretty.
Well, what
incredible.
Was their response? That was what I drowned you out. That was what? Incredible.
Yeah.
What was their response to you saying what you said?
Nothing. No one responded to me.
Because you were a sub-deanie? Were you a sub-deanie by that point and they knew it?
A few people knew it because I was using that name that I had been using on Cloak and Dagger and on the McLuhan Institute site. But
name being what?
Ad Absurdum.
Okay, so was that your first... That wasn't your first time in Alt Slack.
It was one of the first five posts, anyway, that I'd ever done on Alt.Slack. I don't think it was my very first, but I think it actually was one of these situations where I meant to have my entry or something be very planned, but then that coincidence just shocked me so much that I just had to respond to it right away, so
yeah,
my plans went out the window.
Yeah, you ejaculated quick, pre-ejaculate. You know, you overdid it, or you did it too fast, or something. And suddenly, you were thrown in there by the synchronicity. And you, so there was no response, and that was that. Did you tell them who about Slobbering Anus in your response?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay, yeah. But nobody cared.
Yeah, I said that's what my band's about. I said we get caught in log jams on our smear campaign to announce bottoms up to the Solar Anus.
And Solar Anus being a phrase from Bataille.
Yeah.
B-A-T-A-I.
Because it used to be if you typed Slobbering Anus into Google, then that essay would be the first thing that comes up because the word slobbering is in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But now I've taken it over.
Yeah, you didn't take the phrase Slobbering Anus from Bataille's essay.
No. I took that from something a friend spontaneously said in response to what some sound sounded like.
Right, but that now you're saying
years
that
before.
Right, and the phrase "slobbering anus," though, is in the famous essay by Bataille, which is Bataille. That essay, the Solar Anus or whatever it is, the phrase "slobbering anus" is in there.
No. The word "slobbering" is in, I think, the very first paragraph. It's like right there in the first sentence or something
of his essay.
And,
right.
Yeah. So if you typed that into Google, that was the closest hit.
To
so
you,
that,
you would come up and connected to that.
I do now.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned the Solar Anus. Great. All right. So
then that just started it off back then. But there was a big resonance to lately on Leap Day 2008. There's all sorts of other stuff leading up to Leap Day that I'll attempt to get to it all.
Yeah.
As I don't have a home internet connection, so I generally miss most of what's going on as it happens. Like, most of the time on Alt Slack, when I've responded to threads, it's been after the fact. The argument has already happened a few days ago. It's not an active thread. I only find it by searching relevant themes or looking at your profile or something or being told about it, and then I comment later. But one of the things that I there was something going on 5Body that I did not participate in, and I didn't get to see the thread until Leap Day, but there was a conversation that you were having with Joan that ended up leading up to, on February 29th, was when you, she had asked, like, the day before or something, that I read about how James Joyce was obsessed with farts, or obsessed with his wife's farts.
Yeah.
And she asked you, like, how does that, so how does that play into The Secret of Finnegan's Wake or something?
Yeah.
And then you responded saying, like, well, that's everything, because what do you think the Ten Thunders are? Or something, I don't know exactly what you said, but
yeah,
you basically implied that it's the ten farts.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
So, you know, they're the mud, they're the muddest thick that was ever heard dumped in Joyce's phrase.
Yes.
And so that stunned me at the time, that, like, wow, Leap Day, what, 4 years later, comes around to Joan getting this revelation that, like, Finnegan's Wake is, like, basically the narrative is moved forward by enormous farts of God.
The slobbering anus, capital S, capital A.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Great slobbering anus. Solar slobbering anus.
So that happened.
Then probably the next thing I would check, but also on Leap Day 2008 turned out to be the day that again an old, exactly the same old argument between Joe Cosby and Polar Bear, basically about whether Polar Bear, like, has a right to enjoy your post, I think you have something to say, came to the point where Polar Bear said, this is my last post to Alt.Flag.
Yeah.
Left. And he said that on February 29th.
Wow.
And I came across it there that day, also too late to jump in, whereas when Joe Cosby and Polar Bear had been going off on that before, there's an older thread from, I think, 2004 or 5, where I was away at Burning Man, and him and Polar Bear and Joe had been going at it back and forth, and then when I came back and read this whole back and forth thing all at once, it, like, built me up to the point where I got really mad at Joe and, like, tried to tear him apart on the net. So that was another one of these timing things where I'm away and then come in at the perfect time or something. But just the Joe Cosby Polar Bear thing came to a head on Leap Day.
Right, but and are you looking at this on Leap Day?
Yeah, I did see that on Leap Day.
Right.
And I finally got out to the internet on Leap Day.
And then the Joan thing happened just before.
Yeah, it was simultaneously five-bodied. Joan was learning that Finnegan's Wake is about the solar slobbering anus, and on all that slack, Polar Bear was saying, okay, you know what, maybe I don't really belong here, and this is my last post to all that slack.
Right.
The Leap Day also, I was already amazed leading up to Leap Day, because just this year, because just a few days before Leap Day, I had been wandering around, and I wandered up to Elliot's bookstore on Yonge Street, which is pretty near the U of T, and I go in there, I go up to check the section that, actually, Elliot, this is important, I almost forgot this, didn't remember it till now, that Elliot's bookstore is the place where I bought my copies of the Book of the Subgenius and Revelation X. Used, I'm afraid. Sorry, everyone's saying, but
years ago. Yeah.
Although not before X Day, not that long ago. But I bought my used copies of those books at that bookstore in the same section. Like, it's pretty small sections, like media, culture, whatever. Like thrown together, they both would have shown up there. And in that same, on the same shelf that I got my Subgenius books off of, there's a hardcover copy of The Mechanical Bride, which, as a book geek, makes my eyes bling open. Wow,
yeah.
A hardcover Mechanical Bride. So I pick it up, and I open it up, and much to my astonishment, glued into the inside front cover, also astonished as a book geek, because, you know, this is a hardcover of McLuhan's first book, so you'd think that you'd just fold it in there, you wouldn't glue it onto the thing. But anyway, glued onto the inside front cover is a clipping
from the Globe and Mail newspaper of an article that I had read before on the internet by the title of Things Get Ugly in the World of Underground Art, which, of course, is about you and the whole thing. And it's dated Tuesday, March 30th, 1993. And so I'd read the article before because ModeMac links to it. ModeMac cites it as part of their, you know, proof that you're crazy, or particularly as part of the proof that you're lying when you say that Bob Marshall isn't you.
Right.
And then, and so that blew me away that that happened to be in there. And it seems that someone bought this book in New York. It's like someone, there's a little sticker in it. It says NYC 1993 from someone's library. And I don't know when they sold it to Elliot's or whatever, but I was there at just the right time to pick it up. And that kind of amazed me because I had another experience where I had this, I don't remember the exact time, but probably when the new Subgenius book was in production, I think, just because just the general time frame, and I had gone to a Goodwill, so I was like looking at, you know, very cheap books at the Goodwill, and sometimes they're really interesting, and of all things, I found at the Goodwill a copy of Take Today, The Executive as Dropout, just like a nice rare book, sitting there for $2.
Wow.
And I had remembered looking on the internet and seeing that Nelson Ball was selling that book for $150.
Yes, maybe even about.
So
he sold
here
it. Nelson was back in the early 90s as the McLuhan revival started. He, you know, because of McLuhan being Painter's State of Wired or something, he put out a little leaflet charging $1,000 for a copy of Counterblast, which people couldn't get back then. And, yeah, very high price for Take Today. I don't know if it's $150, but you may be right. And an actual Italian professor did buy Counterblast for $1,000 back then.
Wow. Wow. I did end up finding a used copy of Counterblast, and it wasn't super cheap, but it was, you know, less than $50 anyway.
What was Mechanical Bride?
Let's see, $39.95.
Well, that's good.
And usually I do not have that much money to spend on a book, but I did that day. So that's even, for me, that's part of the luck, that I even have $40 to blow on a book. I never buy books for anything usually over than $5.
Right. The Mechanical Bride in the 80s, I think, was $80 approximately, I remember. So you got a good deal there.
Yeah, I guess so. The but I, you know, I mean, it made me laugh very hard, the deal I was getting at the Goodwill. Because not only had I happened to see on the internet that, and I know that it definitely was $150 he was selling for it, because tucked into the front cover of the copy of it that I got at the Goodwill was a little brochure for Time Again Productions.
Yeah,
it was Ball's whole catalog. So it's funny that they put a $2 sticker on a book that right on the inside cover shows you what the price is.
Yeah, $150.
Which is 75 times that.
And that is, what day is that?
Or, you know, what? I don't know the exact date, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so the I would say that incident happened in 2006, because that's the year the Bob Biographer came out. So that's that. We got the timing, not the exact month. And then
that makes sense if it was the Bob Biographer's in production, because for me, I would, especially at that time, I would identify finding that book with kind of a slackonomics, in the sense that just through timing, I happened to pick up this rare, difficult to find, and if you can find it, it's expensive book for $2, at plus the Time Again Productions catalog. So, but the new and then is that the when I found this Mechanical Bride with the Globe and Mail article in it, the first thing that I noticed that was different from what I knew about the article from the internet was that it has a giant Dobbs head on it, and I, because there's the cover of the Arise video, and I mentioned that on alt.slack as a point, I don't need to harp on it here, but just like, why do you have such a poor sense of humor that you can't notice that because of all of this stuff happening in Toronto with the horrendous fake Canadian church debacle, actually got a Dobbs head into this nationally distributed paper, which went all over the place that morning of March 30th, 1993. So there's the Dobbs head aspect, but then the next thing I noticed...
Before you go
into
that, let's explain. The Globe and Mail is the upper literate, sophisticated cast, and it goes in all the boardrooms, and...
It's the one that, it would be the more elite-ish paper.
Yeah, and it's in the gas station, so millions of people would see the Dobbs head on March 30th, 93, and that's millions of dollars of advertising.
Yeah.
Thanks to me.
Free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hooray. If only it was that simple for people to appreciate. Apparently, it is not that simple.
No.
Anyway, but I mentioned that on Alt.Flag. But then the other thing that I noticed, and this is on the Internet, although I hadn't really seen it this way, is that the article is written by a guy by the name of Robert Everett Green, and which to me immediately suggests Bob Neverett Dean.
Yes.
Because on your chart, you got Bob Neverett, you got Bob Dean, or two of the names. And, of course, they mentioned Bob Dean all over the article, but not Bob Neverett.
And it's under the color green.
Yeah, and green. And, I mentioned that on Alt.Flag just a couple days ago, too. And so it had never occurred to me that that article was perhaps written by you. But then as I read the article again, numerous things seemed to suggest that it was written by you. And, let's see, what things? There's the way that Reverend Stang is quoted as contradicting himself. The two quotes of him directly contradict himself. Dave Neufeld is given his kind of like chance to not look like such the villain that the subgenii would tend to think that he is.
Yeah.
He's given his say on it. Another thing that's in here, at that time, you might have wanted to take the heat off of Bob Marshall somehow, and this author seems to make it very clear that Bob Marshall is definitely just you, just another name of yours.
Yeah.
Even though, of course, I and a number of other people have met Bob Marshall, and he's not you.
Yeah.
But, of course, we can't be believed because we're not a link on the Internet.
What are the quotes? How does Stang contradict himself?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. Two quotes from Reverend I'm Stang. We have, once a year, somebody shows up who thinks he's Jesus Christ and Bob wrapped up together, Stang says in an irritated Texas drawl. This time, the guy found a sugar daddy. But then the other quote is, we've always encouraged people to take the ball and run with it. But nobody's ever come along and said, I am the ball, run with me. So, someone who has never heard of the Church of Subgenius might, they're like trying to parse this, and they might notice the direct contradiction there and think that's a bit odd. But the thing that really, to me, clinched it as far as reading this article and thinking, my word, is this written by Bob, is that not only is the one person who's involved in all this, who is not quoted or consulted for this article, is you, which would imply you're the author, but this very strange thing towards the end, listen to this. Thal claims he is under no obligation to the Church of the Subgenius and scoffs at Stang's published threats of legal action. You can't copyright a name, he says. However, Thal isn't a stranger to legal wranglings over nomenclature. His lawyers once sent threatening letters to the University of Toronto's McLuhan Program in Culture and Technology, claiming that the program's use of the word center was compromising the identity of Thal's business-oriented Marshall McLuhan Center on Global Communication. Derek DeKirchhoff, head of the McLuhan Program, says that his organization neither did nor could have called itself a center because of university regulation. So it's this strange little vignette that makes Thal look so strange.
Yeah.
And makes DeKirchhoff just look kind of like bemused, nonplussed, like, what are you talking about? We never call ourselves a center or a program. And when I read it in the new light of thinking maybe you wrote this article, then it looks almost like a way of indicating how ridiculous the whole subgenius plagiarism accusation looks, in the sense of like, well, you know, all I did was use this name or something, but
yeah.
I didn't even call myself JR, you know, or something like that.
Yes.
Like, it seems like it couldn't have really happened. It seems like it was made up. But and then the funny thing is, I had never met Derek DeKirchhoff, but right after Elliot's bookstore is very near the McLuhan Coach House, and in fact, the Coach House was halfway between the bookstore and where I live. So as I was walking home, I dropped by there to see if anyone was there, and sure enough, Derek DeKirchhoff was there, and I met him briefly and showed him, like, hey, look, I just got this great score, Hardcover Mechanical Bride, and hey, look, you're mentioned in this article. You know, and he was like, oh, yeah, that's great, look. So we like, had a look at it there. And so basically, I read over the article again, and multiple things convinced me that, yep, oh, my, wow, what a coup. This not only is it already funny enough because of not being able to appreciate the free publicity, but Bob actually wrote it, and no one has guessed it in, like, 15 years. Is what it seems to me. But then yesterday you told me that you did not write this article. And I believe you and I accept it completely. And the only reason I do is because I have had way more incredible coincidences happen to me over the years involved in all this than the idea that it would just happen by accident that this guy happens to have a name that couldn't be any closer to seeming like a pseudonym for you than it already is. Like, yeah, that seems like just the kind of coincidence that the meme would arrange to be funny. So I'm perfectly willing to believe you didn't write this article.
Right.
There is some guy named Robert Everett Green.
Right, and you
say that Worcester lives in Everett, Washington?
Yes, and we're focusing, it was around February 2008, I started to think, we need to interview Dave, and we actually interviewed him a few weeks later on March 16th, the interview that's in the Paranoia magazine now and out in the full one is on the website. Yeah, so Worcester and Everett was on my mind when you encountered the Everett meme.
Yeah.
And the thing is, this synchronicity that you've experienced with me helps you to believe I didn't do it. But if you haven't experienced the synchronicity with me, you would think that I'm lying when I say I had nothing to do with the Bosmy Calls the album.
Yeah. You know? No, I'd be like, oh, please, another lie.
Yeah.
Another lie. Oh, come on the face of it. Like, please, just look at it. It's like I've learned to know that the face of it can arrange itself into a perfect face completely by accident.
Yes.
Or just completely through meme timing.
Yes, it's like the Android meme is conspiring to make sure that I look guilty, no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, if you are only looking at the situation through the media.
Yes.
But as someone who, you know, I guess lives in Toronto and can meet people in press the flesh and whatever, and then you get a different view on it, and you experience incredible synchronicities, and you start to just believe that these things, it's an incredible, you know, it's really relieving on the old paranoia or something.
Yes.
Because, like, you know, if I start thinking that, then it's like, oh, like, not only is Bob not some marginal freak that no one will take seriously, but he can just get an article printed in the Globe and Mail, no problem.
Excellent. So the, don't know if we got this on tape, what was the street that the guy driving by today went, fuck yeah, what street was that?
College Street.
All right, and that was opposite the library.
Yeah.
The library?
The Lillian Smith Library.
Oh, yeah, right. So the thing is, that's College Street. Now, I'm pretending to offer graduate, postgraduate, university education that you can't get in at, quote, university or college. So you're experiencing the real college, the electoral college, on the street when the synchrony continues today.
Yeah.
With this article, which is attached to a major text in our curriculum, The Mechanical Bride.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to top it off a little more of, like, I mean, I might not even be able to get into all these different aspects of the synchrony of, like, why it was doubly meaningful for me that this article, to learn that this article had a face attached to it,
yeah,
was another thing that had been on my mind lately. Well, I can say that because I had been I had been reading Deleuze and Guattari, who are kind of like the whipping boys of postmodernism. I think it's their language that pisses everyone off about Pomo, because they really indulge in the super 8-syllable neologisms and all this.
Right.
But I've been reading one of the sections of their book on faciality, where they basically probably the bottom line is that there's a difference between, the face is something abstract that is more of an idea that evolves and is then kind of added onto the head, like that used to be our more animal head.
Yes.
But all the sections of their book have dates, and they date faciality as year zero and assign it to, Christ, that's basically the main aspect of Christianity, is that it's like a face religion. And of course, the Church is so genius, especially in the new book, say explicitly, all these people want to talk about faith-based values. Well, we have faith-based values. Our values are based on that faith. And so opening up the article and seeing that face was right there on the article, it doubly confirms any thought I may have had about how the Church of the Subgenius is finally the true obsolescence of pink Christianity or something, because it's like it's a better face-based religion. But in the faciality chapter of the Deleuze and Guattari book, at one point that was synchronous for me. I was on the train coming back into Toronto on Leap Day. This is a couple days after finding the book. As I'm finishing the chapter on faciality, I come across a part where they mention Joan of Arc. And
wow.
I had just read her learning from you that Finnegan's Wake is all about the 10 farts of the solar anus, that they are the wind, so to say, that drives the narrative forward.
Right.
So
now, two points here. Yeah, the Joan of Arc, you're on the train later in the day, or a couple days later, but you have read, you're reading the book on February 29th, and you have seen Joan's post on Five Bodied already that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, earlier that morning, I saw it. And then I'm on the train seeing that in the faciality part they mentioned Joan of Arc. So that was another thing that tied into that, and just the importance of the face to the church, and the idea that it's not just that the Church's subgenius got some publicity through this article, but that the face got printed, the sacred face, that mystical arrangement of pixels of Bob's face got printed more than a million times, distributed all over Canada.
Right.
Well, maybe it's not more than a million. I don't know. We're a small country.
Right.
But,
now,
let
me say this. I got two points to add there. First of all, in my essay, Literate Aesthetic Cliché Probes in the Classroom Without Walls, where I show all the famous postmodernists were one up by McLuhan, everything they say, McLuhan said earlier, including in Take Today. That's the meaning of you. The bibliography is in production, but the real bibliography, or a better or an anticipation of it, is Take Today, the executivist dropout, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What's Bob Dodd? J.R. Bob Dodd is an executive of the Inner Councils of Conspiracy who dropped out. That's what he did.
Yeah.
He dropped out.
Yeah, that is his archetype. He's the dropout.
Yeah. Now, there's that thing, but take any idea of Deleuze and Guattari, and I inventory them, how they're already in McLuhan. McLuhan made the point back in the early 70s when he was working out the left hemisphere and right hemisphere, that you see it on his chart in the book Laws of Media, which is dated 8/8/88. In there, in the chart, he points out that right hemisphere people and cultures can have and see faces. They have facial recognition. Literate people don't have facial recognition. They can't remember faces. Okay?
Absolutely.
So that if Christ, and McLuhan says, I don't know if it's in Take Today, but he says it back then, that Christ represented tribal oral values in relation to the new visual space that the Roman bureaucracy was bringing in. So Christ was bringing back right hemisphere recognition of the face, and he becomes the face of the anti-environment for 2,000 years.
And then somewhere in McLuhan, I think it's maybe through The Vanishing Point or something, he relates the story of some photographer, I think, having a conversion experience after developing one of their photos that was aerial photography of some mountainous region, and one of the photos came out looking like a perfect, just black and white contrast blobs portrait of Christ.
That's right. That's in The Electric Light. You know, the book dealing with Marshall's Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
So that seems like another perfect parable of the faciality religion thing.
Right. So then the Church Sub Genius breaks up obsolete Christian values by retrieving the right hemisphere essence of Christianity for a right hemisphere time when the electricity brings back the right hemisphere, puts it back into dominance. Mm-hmm. They replay the Christian motif of the faciality.
One face fits all.
Yes. And so when they say they've declared war on God, we need me to explain, well, they declared war on the left hemisphere aspect of God, the Puritan WASP Christianity, but they've retrieved the right hemisphere part of God, and they failed to declare war on that God, which I do, so I'm more comprehensive.
Yeah.
Because you can't see me. Nobody has seen me. I focus on radio. You can't find the Bob face. My face.
Well, that's why it's so funny that your face is on Paranoia number 44.
Yeah, as the only man alive. So you suddenly, when you do see my face, it's in the context that you don't exist to even see me, because you ain't alive. I'm the only one.
You didn't see that.
What?
You didn't see that face.
You didn't see that
face. You're not even here.
Okay, but the the other point is that MODMAC uses the Globe and Mail article for his Bible. But he has pleaded for somebody to send in the full article that came out of this magazine. That's what it's called, This Magazine, a Toronto intellectual magazine, in 1990, I think, September 1990. I don't know if it's a monthly or a weekly back then, but yeah, it must have been a monthly. September 1990, there's an article on me. And there's an actual picture of me and Connie. And Connie is holding up Laws of Media, and I'm holding up LaRouche's Dope Inc. Okay? Huh. Now, it's a good article. De Kirchhoff is quoted in there as saying that the Bob he knows, you know, eats, sleeps, and farts McLuhan 24/7. You know what I mean?
Really?
That's De
Kirchhoff. Wow, that's a dangerous citation.
That's right. And the... So it has a lot of interesting details, but the writer didn't know fully what was going on, so he misspelt Mae Brussel and things like that. But the MODMAC has half the article, and he's pleading for someone to give him the other half. And he has never, as far as I know, or it would be on his website, he has not found the other half. I'm the only guy who has that article. They got to go to me. They got to pay millions for the other half of the article.
If I suddenly stumbled across that article in the next few days, it would not even surprise me.
Right.
That's the point it's reached. I'd be like, ah, there you go.
You'd
be like, oh, my God. No, I'd be like, wow, okay, perfect.
Yep,
great.
Yep. Bob ordered it, Bob declared it, I receive it.
Yeah, that settled it.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about this little incident of millions of them. Is there anything more about the article? Have we exhausted that?
Oh, probably.
Maybe something else will come up.
For the time being, anyway. Maybe I could jump over to just, your face was on Paranoia number 44, which clearly I'm sure that's not an accident.
No, it isn't, because the previous issue I'm in is number 22.
Yeah.
Of Paranoia.
Of course. But there are all sorts of other 44s that come up. And I mean, it's interesting that, it's an interesting, as far as Bob Zanocrony, there's, like, that is a, how do I say this? That's a genuine, I guess, I don't know, that's a part of the subgenius thing anyway, because they talk about like, oh, they're always using Bob now to represent just the kind of slackful everyman who's gonna be the salesman on the ad to convince you about to buy something like Bob likes Doritos or something. And it's kind of this tension between, say, you'd be watching a movie and there would be a character that would be named Bob, and it would be the most kind of J.R. Bob Dobbs, this character that was in that movie, and it makes you wonder, like, now, did that person name that guy Bob because they know it's a genius, or is it just part of the coincidence?
Yeah.
There's plenty of coincidence stuff, too. We've reached an interesting point now where when Bob's anachronies like this show up in the major media...
Do you mean their J.R. Bob Dobbs anachrony or my anachrony?
Well, this is what I'm saying, that they have less of an argument that it's their anachrony than you do. Like, I mean, I wasn't reading it, like, I don't read it obsessively or anything, but I'm sure that they made some kind of a deal over the fact that the guy who kind of was launched into the White House half by accident in the major movie was named Tom Dobbs. Right?
Yeah.
So they could be like, oh, great, it's Dobbs, yeah, Dobbs. He's just on the radio, and then he got into the White House. But you're better placed to say that's about me than they are to say that that's about their Bob.
Yes, because I've been... go ahead.
Partially because this is the... what we're leading up to, the next president is going to be the 44th president.
Yes.
And, of course, now it turns out that we have a... candidate whose name could hardly be closer to Bob. The guy's name is like B.O.B. Barack Obama. Like, there's Bob right there. He stands a chance to be the 44th president.
Yeah, Barack. And, B for Barack. You could have B. Yeah. Obama, B for Barack. And then Obama is O.B. And then you have A.M. for Android Meme. And then A can be a Bob A.M. or A.P. You can point to anyways the A. But the amazing thing is that you were walking down the street. Okay, before we go into that, he's not 44.
Yeah.
He's not 44, but the person who may beat him is Glow. And Glow's real name was Sarah. I won't give her last name.
Really?
Yes. And Sarah
Palin is 44.
Sarah Palin's 44. She's got everything she got everything going for her.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, no, it's not just that she's a woman or something and is kind of young to counterbalance McCain. They picked her because she's got 44 pounds.
Exactly.
She's trying to fight the Bob energy, that's why.
Did you see her speech, her acceptance speech? Well, I caught it on YouTube because I'm not monitoring TV daily, but I caught it on YouTube, and it's incredible. McCain is standing beside her. I don't know if they do this regularly, but, you know, when someone gives a speech, you need to have the guy you're talking about standing beside you. But anyway, he's standing beside Sarah like the proud father. He's sitting there with his macho chest, you know, his POW chest, and he's sitting there just smirking everybody. He says, top this one, guys! Right beside her.
Wow.
Beaming out. Look at it on YouTube. It's pretty amazing what he's emanating.
Okay.
Okay,
sure.
Back to the, so you've known the Bob Obama, Bob thing, and what happened yesterday, or 2 days ago?
The day before, my lady and I were walking down the street, and we noticed a Obama t-shirt that was purple and green. It was in this high contrast, almost like... you know, before the election is even over, they're already making a Warholian icon out of the guy's face. But it was a t-shirt that was purple and green, and purple and green are your colors, as I've long known for a while. Green is in the chart on your thing, and you're purple.
Yeah,
all about flag. So,
and they are Zappa's colors too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to say about develop what you're saying. Yeah, the thing is, they poo-poo the idea of xenocrony, media synchronicity. Not synchronicity between people, but synchronicity in the media. The living Android meme, trying to be like a living human organism, creates synchronicity for those that can perceive it. And that's xenocrony. I've been explaining this for decades, and they deny it, but when it comes up, they just sort of get stunned by it and say, hey, that's us, but they can't explain it. I get the lockdown, the ownership of this, because I explain it.
Yeah.
That's what I think you were leading up to, is that seems to me that I explain it, predict it, and when it happens, I tell them why it happened. They just say, oh, that's us!
Yeah. Yeah, and they don't want to notice that there's actually, like, there really is just more to suggest that it's either xenocrony or, like,
that either it's an anachrony or the writer deliberately named the character Dobbs, but they could have, it's very ambiguous. Like, did they name it Dobbs after their Dobbs, or do they name it Dobbs after you Dobbs?
That's right.
You're the Dobbs on the radio that says, I'm going to be, like, now I'm getting ready to be president.
Yeah.
You ended the paranoia interview there in number 44.
Right. Did you know that, have you seen me explain that the Tom Dobbs movie is based on him getting into a glitch in what I would call the Android meme, but it's a glitch in the movie, in the computer software.
Oh. Now I remember that now, yeah.
Here's the point. Here's the amazing...
I didn't see the movie, though.
Okay. You haven't seen it, but you remember that description.
Yeah.
Here's the amazing... This will put you back on your feet again. The way I won the Secret Council 10 in February 88, which is... got a leap year. I'm just thinking, that must be a leap year. It's every 4 years?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it goes 2008, 2004, 2096, 92, 88. So
yeah,
right around the leap year, February 88, or leap day, that's when I held the Secret Council 10 election. And I said that if people took my home number and called it in and left a message on that number, it would affect the computer, which would then get confused and then bypass Prince Charles and turn taxes and elect me Secret Council of 10. I was saying, and then of course I did win, and I thanked everybody for doing it because the computer glitch worked for me, which is literally what happens to Tom Dobbs.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I post these statements, doesn't register on anybody, but when I say it verbally to you, you have to stand on your feet and applaud. Because that is amazing.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I mean, you said that in one of your essays or writings or the diaries or something. You know, that's up there on the internet or something. And so when these people write their script about that, who say that they're not basing it on this? Oh, this is obscure and marginal enough that it's not gonna be obvious what we stole.
Yeah,
you know, we'll use this little story like. Like how, you know, not that I'm like constantly just like getting off on the idea of them being frustrated, but like, who's to say that like how are they going to like the idea of thinking about that you were the one that inspired the Dodds character in the major motion picture rather than them, you know?
Right, and because their retrieval of right hemisphere values, they don't explain anything. That's too left hemisphere verbal. They just wallow in the retrieved effect of the electric environment and celebrate the face. Or when they see Zanarko, they just point. You know, they don't know how to retrieve their left hemisphere and talk around the topic and be comprehensive as the right hemisphere effect comes in.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's, the all dots lag. It's amazing. And I mean, when I was in a rush, but on All That Slack a couple of days ago, I detailed some of the things, not all of them even, but some of the things about this article in the Globe and Mail that made it seem like you wrote it. And, you know, Stang responded to it, like, I don't even believe him, like, he's a smart guy, but he responded to it as if, like, he couldn't even tell what I was getting at.
Yeah.
You know?
And now they do a lot of verbal ranting, but that's right hemisphere ranting. What I mean by left hemisphere is that you organize a visual space science. You have definitions, you have statistics, you have facts, and you explain things with this old left hemisphere model. See, now that we live in the corpus callosum, which is in between the two brains, and you're watching the translation of right-left hemisphere and the environments that are extensions of that, you can use both. That's the paramedia yoga. You can use both modalities and be detached, but use it playfully as archetypal art forms or whatever. But if you are swept up in the present, you will just be a ranting idiot, and or you will celebrate a face, but you cannot, when the FBI comes around and interrogate you, name the science that you're talking about and fit the whole church thing as a laboratory experiment, as content for the left hemisphere framework you're using, which is a bunch of definitions. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean, that they can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear you.
Okay.
So I'm trying to think what I should go into next. Well, okay, here's a funny little anecdote. Because today is the 14th of the 9th month, I thought, okay, well, who knows, maybe we'll get some good Zanocrony. So I opened up The Mechanical Bride to page 149. And it's just a reprint of the table of contents from an issue of Reader's Digest.
Yeah.
But one of the stories on it is the American minister stood by his guns.
Yeah, perfect. That's the sub-genies. Yeah. That's a sub-genies versus a sub-dinies.
Yeah.
They just stand by their guns. They just say, shut up!
Yeah. Well, I mean... Yeah, I mean, apparently, like, Stang felt he had to stand by his guns or something and not acknowledge the suggestion that maybe you wrote that article, or maybe if you didn't write that article, that there's, you know, like, that Bob managed to get the word out about the church by any inverted means necessary and give them great free publicity he should be celebrated for. You know, he stood by his guns by basically being like, what are you talking about? This is incoherent, like, I don't know, like what? So one other guy was gullible? I don't get it.
Perfect.
As standing by the guns of being, like, of pretending to be a fucking dumbass, apparently.
Yes, pretending to be a dumbass. Now, the other thing is that when I was in London in April, and I was on Ben Watson, the author of Negative Dialectics of Poodle Play, you know, really good biography of Zappa. I was on his radio show. Of course, I made sure that the Stang them knew I was going on, so that they flooded the little station, internet station, whatever it is, community station in London, with complaints and caused a big flack, and Ben had to justify it all, and that created a lot of publicity. So then I get on after that and have 3 hours. And then there's a lot of talk after about that. So Hell Pope Huey comes on and says, hey, guys, this guy has gotten, meaning me, has gotten so much more publicity than we'll ever get in our little fingernails. I think we should appreciate this. And
No, don't say that. Don't say that.
Yeah. And I think shortly after that, I haven't seen him for months. He probably dropped off after that. He's probably reached the ad observant level of epiphany. He's basking in the glow of contemplating this strange phenomenon.
Ouch.
Yes.
That's a hard loss. He's an old timer.
That's a what?
That's a hard loss. He's a veteran hierarch.
That's right. Okay. Now, is there more about the Allslack world, or do we move to other levels? The metaphysics?
Oh.
The big cycle?
Here's one example of another, because sometimes I just get much more minor things with all thought slack, but I found this one pretty funny. There's this song by a band called Ween. Ween are one of the best candidates for like a who's carrying the Zappa torch or something, at least as far as being genre hoppers. They're really good at putting on different musical styles.
That's Quadrophenia.
They don't really have a style.
Yeah, that's Quadrophenia.
Yeah. Like,
now, how do,
Ween,
spell, how, do you,
mu-
how do you spell Ween?
W-E-E-N.
Oh, okay.
So Ween's musical style could only be said, like, their genre is putting on different genres. Like, they couldn't be said to have a basic style.
Right.
And I've been listening to some music of theirs lately, and, I forget exactly the time it was, but there was, whenever the thing, one of the last things that Absurdum said on All Thought Slack had to do with after Stang started a thread saying, we watched The King of Comedy last night. And right around that time, I had been listening to a lot of Ween, and particularly there's an album of theirs called Quebec, right next door to Nova Scotia, not quite, but an album called Quebec that has a song called Hey There, Fancy Pants.
Yeah.
It's this very funny song, like it's, I don't know, I'm not going to describe it, but I'd been starting the day with this song, so it's very upbeat and silly.
Is this 2008? When is it, 2008?
Yeah, this year.
Okay.
I'd been listening to this song a lot, right around the exact same, like I'd been starting the day every day for a week with this song right around the time this thread started. And I commented on it saying, you know, like, did you notice, like, what, you didn't notice that the king, like, you're talking about this Rupert Pupkin character as if he's Bob, but, like, you didn't notice that, like, Bob has that movie on his chart, like, for all these years.
In the Dobbs Quadrant. In the Dobbs Quadrant.
Yeah, right up there.
Yeah.
And because, you know, Stang was hamming up about how he's like, this is a terrifying horror movie for me. And it's like, well, yeah, but did you notice that, like, this Rupert Pupkin character didn't turn into, like, sure, he kidnapped the guy, but he didn't, it wasn't some drama of his psycho rage at the guy. He just wanted to get past him and onto the TV. Anyway, just, so I said some things about that. But Saudi, Freighter Saudi, the guy who's just the automaton of Shut Up, Deanie.
Yeah, S-O-D-D-I.
Yeah. He posted all of a sudden saying, well, hello there, Mr. Fancy Pants. Right there in that thread. Which I don't know, I guess maybe that's a line from the movie. I hadn't seen it in years, but, you know, that's perfect right there. So, and then I'm like, am I going to bother to take the time to, like, mention, like, oh, by the way, you just totally plugged into yet another proof that this guy is, like, the closest thing to the, you know, the luck plane follows him around claim about J.R. Bob Dawes. Like, you did it again, you just proved it to me. Like, no, I'm not even going to bother, like, saying anything about that, because it's just too painful for me to see these people falling all over themselves, like, to deny it all, so I'm not even going to bring it up. But that, they said that right there. I've been listening to that song, like, every day for a week. Like, hello, Fancy Band.
Amazing. So, you know, Arthur Coker talks about the only resistance to the Android meme. He doesn't use that term, but he's discussing the chip body landscape in his books in the early 90s. The only resistance, I think he's saying Baudrillard offers this resistance, but maybe not. No, he says Baudrillard doesn't offer this, though Baudrillard might disagree, because he had a falling out with Coker, apparently, later on. Had you heard of that?
No.
Okay. So, Coker says the only resistance is human stubbornness. Okay, that's all we got, just human stubbornness. And so that is what these guys are doing at Slack. We celebrate them for highlighting human stubbornness to resist the Android Meme's facts as shown by me.
Yeah.
That's the value they're revolving around, human stubbornness. And they could even say, well, we know Bob Dobbs, up in Canada, is the real Dobbs, but we will kill him. We can't kill him in person, so we will kill him by our human stubbornness to deny to the day we die that he is what he says he is. That's what they're doing.
Yeah. We're going to keep just, like, sticking endless pins and launching endless, you know, missiles onto this effigy of him rather than kill him.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good one. I mean that, and you could have, if you post them back on Per McClue, Cloak and Dagger through the years, these weird things, you're walking down the street and I posted something or something I said, and then you see it right on the bus stop or something, that's been going on for 5 years for you.
Yeah.
And aren't we on the anniversary that maybe, I don't know if you've explained the synchronicity of how you encountered me through the Cloak and Dagger show.
I had gone to a lecture of Michael Rupert's about
Rupert. Michael Rupert. Michael Rupert.
Yeah, Michael Rupert. Of the I'm too literate. I've heard that a million times, but I see the way his name's spelled and I have to just, like, go by the rules or something. Anyway, I had gone to a lecture of his about all the problems with the ridiculous, notion, like the story of what happened that fateful day.
Yeah.
And so I had gone to this lecture, and the people who put it on, Sumari Seminars, they were giving out a list of our upcoming seminars, and one of the ones on the list was Bob Dobbs, quote, the emperor is wearing clothes. Which to me was hilarious enough that I completely, there was no thought in my mind that it wasn't Church of the Subgenius based. Like, it didn't seem to me like this is just some guy whose name happens to be that, or that they, you know, like, it was a funny joke. And I thought, wow, that's great. Like, I never I didn't really expect that any serious conspiracy researchers would actually would be taking seriously the church's contribution. Because to me, you know, almost in a very practical and real sense, but also in a more literary sense, that it's a good insight into getting a grasp on this conspiracy theory world is to capitalize conspiracy and call it the conspiracy singular and deal with it like that. Which, so to me, it seemed like, oh, great, like this is going to be, like they actually have a seminar coming up where what, someone's going to be, I mean, obviously there is no, like, it's not going to be a Bob Dobbs talking, there is no, but, you know, what is this going to be? But there was a link there to the McLuhan Institute site.
Yeah.
But I didn't follow it right away because, again, didn't have a home internet connection.
I have a question, Ed Ab. How long before that had you been reading or studying the Book of the Subgenius?
Well, it frustrates me that I don't have a definite date, because now that I'm like a Xenocrony cartographer, I would really like to be able to triangulate exactly when I first like bought the first book. But I don't know exactly. It was either late 1999 or sometime in the first, it was winter of 99-2000 was when I first got into it.
Which is when I showed up on the cover of Paranoia magazine. It's a winter 2000 issue.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Guffey article.
Yeah, and issue number 22 is called It's Winter 2000. But the point is that you were well-versed in the Church Subgenius for a couple of years before you saw this flyer, and when it says the emperor is wearing clothes, that struck you as, oh, that's something from the Book of the Subgenius, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I saw that and there was a website listed for the McLuhan Institute, and that perked my ears up too, to think that there was any actual correlation between McLuhan and the Church's Subgenius, or people who took for granted that they relate to each other, which, you know, for me, it's like very plain on the face of it that like McLuhan would be one of the more relevant things to the Subgenius, and vice versa. Which, incredibly, on all that flack, they think McLuhan, like, sucks.
Yeah.
Even though they're occasionally willing to admit, like, okay, he was probably, like, just like us or something, since they're completely inconsistent.
You had a bit of familiarity with McLuhan's writings at that point in 2002.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was into McLuhan, I started getting into McLuhan before I got into Subgenius.
Is that because of a high school teacher, or how did that happen?
No, actually, I just was in some bookstore in Toronto, and I do not know which one, and I don't think it exists anymore because it was a strange setup where it was like a second floor room and the books were laid out on tables. There weren't very many books. It just seemed like a kind of thing like where they just rented the room for a month to sell off excess books or
right.
something. And I bought a copy of Understanding Media that was there, the MIT edition. Because it looked interesting.
And how old were you then?
17 or 17.
Okay, and the Church Subgenius is when you're 18 or 19.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. So you. So that's.